Hey there, this is Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that has walked to the very back of Canto 12 of Dante's masterwork Purgatorio, the second canticle of his even bigger masterwork comedy. We're at lines 118 through 139, the very finish of the long Terrace of Pride in Purgatorio. Well, long in the text, but apparently not so long in the actual being there. There's a problem we'll have to unpack later on in Purgatorio. But for now, we're going to finish off Canto 12, lines 118 through 139. You can find this, my English translation of the medieval Florentine, on my website, markscarborough.com, or walkingwithdante.com. You can print it off. You can make your own notes. Or better yet, you can continue the conversation with me, a conversation then that could include other people who are walking with us on this journey across the known universe, at least across Dante's known universe. Now, as we were climbing up the consecrated stairs, I seemed to be much lighter than I'd been before, even back when the ground was level. So I said, "Master, tell me, what heaviness has been lifted from me such that going along requires barely any effort?" Virgil replied, "When the peas that remain on your brow, though already faint, will have been erased as the first one has been, a properly directed volition will so rain in your feet that they will feel it's no sweat to ascend. In fact, they'll delight in being urged up that way." Then I did as those who walk along with something they don't know about on their heads. They only know about it because the actions of others make them curious about what's going on. I reached up for answers with my hand by touching and feeling around. It accomplished what sight couldn't at that moment. Spreading out the fingers of my right hand, I found that only 6 of the 7 letters were left. The ones he of the keys had traced on my forehead. Watching me do this, my leader smiled. The mere fact that Virgil is lightened up in purgatory is kind of an amazing thing, given that Virgil is damned all through Purgatorio. We'll get to some of that in this episode. What I'd like to do here is pull apart a couple of the interpretive matters inside this passage. They're not all that tough. But then I want to come out to some more difficult, larger questions that involve both the entire Terrace of Pride, and then finally this question of erasing the peas, which is incredibly curious in the text and leads to some, to use the fancy word, semantic problems or some semiotic problems, some problems in the symbol system of Dante's masterwork comedy. Wow, that sounds like a lot to do. Given all that, let's get started. Let's start at the top, the first 3 lines, the first tercet of this passage that we're on. Now, as we were climbing up the consecrated stairs, I seemed to be much lighter than I'd been before, even back when the ground was level. I think this is really important to just stop and think about. We know that these stairways are pretty narrow. The rocks close in. We've seen in this one, they close in so tightly that you can't even tell whether it's the angel singing the Beatitude. They're very narrow restrictions. Dante's term for these consecrated stairs, these narrow restrictions, is fossi, or if you pronounce it in modern Italian, foci. It's probably or likely that Dante said fossi and not foci, but no matter which one. They're from a Latin word for throat that's used in the Aeneid in chapter 6 to refer to a particularly nasty bit of the afterlife. And while I find it often debatable whether etymology has anything to do with how language is practiced, Dante may actually be thinking of the etymological root of this word for the narrow passageway itself from throat in the Latin, because if you think about it, it's reversed. The throat action is reversed. And to be a little gross about this, hell is a throat that swallows people down. And purgatory is a throat that regurgitates people up. It's the direction of the throat. If this is a narrow staircase and a throat, to use the word that Dante often uses for this restricted passageway, then we get this idea that in purgatory, things are coming up. I know that's gross. Things are coming up. But okay, let's just take it. It's a throat. Things are coming up out of the throat as opposed to in hell where things are going back down the throat. And maybe think about it this way. Since Dante thinks this is the purgation of sin, this is as if you ate some bad food. And so you've got to get it out of you lest you be sick. So the coming up is actually a purgation. It's actually a way to survive. I think that's all important to remember as we climb Mount Purgatory, that the throat action is reversed from hell. Hell got narrower and narrower, and everybody seemed gravitationally to be heading down toward the bottom. Now, they're not. They're stuck in the ring they're in Inferno, of course, so I don't want to overstate this. But still, and nonetheless, the general drive, the move, Dante doesn't have a word like gravity, but the general gravitational move is down towards Satan in the ice sheet of Cocytus. That's certainly Let's take the word gravity out of it. That's certainly a narrative move in Inferno. And here we feel this same constricted space, but it's opening out and getting easier as it goes along. Let's take the next nine lines of the passage. So I said, Master, tell me, what heaviness has been lifted from me, such that going along requires barely any effort? He replied, when the P's that remain on your brow, though already faint, will have been erased as the first has been. Okay, two things. This is the first time we know that when the angel brushed or knocked his wing against Dante's forehead, that what he was doing was brushing off one of the P's that the angel of the gate had inscribed in the forehead of Dante. We know, too, here that pride must be a very root sin, because this P for sin, the peccata, the sins that are being expunged in purgatory, this P, its removal, has caused the others to grow fainter. Pride is the root sin in purgatorio. Here's that big $24,000 question. Is pride the root sin in Inferno? Maybe if we consider Satan an exemplar of pride sitting down there at the bottom of hell, maybe it is the very root of it all in Inferno, but it's not so explicitly stated. Here it's much more explicitly stated. And again, just to draw that out just a bit further, when we get down to hell's bottom with Satan and Cocytus, what we're really focusing on is Judas Iscariot and Brutus and Cassius being chewed in his mouth, his three heads, that whole monstrous bit. And all of that is running around a symbolic landscape, of course, but the dominant piece of that symbolic landscape isn't pride. We talked about this endlessly. The three faces, what they represent, the three sinners in Satan's mouths being flayed alive, and how there were two, the Roman assassins there, and then Judas Iscariot, all of that sitting there at the bottom. But from all of that, we can kind of deduce that Satan is an exemplar or the primogenitor even of pride, but we can't actually say pride is part of necessarily that allegorical landscape, except in retrospect from places like this in Purgatorio. So in Purgatorio, we're definitely being directed to the notion that pride is the kind of root of it all, and that's a little bit different, although similar, to Inferno. Reading on in the passage, Virgil says, when all of those P's have been erased, a properly directed volition, or the will, a properly directed will so rein in your feet. The idea here is to put a bridle and pull on it and rein it back. Will so rein in your feet that they will feel it's no sweat to ascend. In fact, they'll delight in being urged up that way. Here we can really see that delight and desire will become the fundamental motivation of comedy. We've known it all along. Ever since Dante gets moving faster at the mention of Beatrice, we've known that desire is at the root of this thing. But here we see it more explicitly stated. And Virgil is saying, when you finally get all the peccata, all the sins, the peas removed from your forehead, your feet will then be, and here's the paradox, so constrained that they'll want to ascend to heaven without even any urging. When desire, which is the primary motivation for Dante, is made right, then the way is made clear. We can think about this two ways. We can think about this, of course, in the theological context. The desire, the yearning for God is made clear once the sins have been scraped off, sure. But also, when your desires are no longer contorted in a humanistic landscape, when they are no longer twisted or wrong, when they settle into their right places, the way ahead becomes clearer. So the restriction actually is the freedom as the desires become clearer. How do I say this to you? When I fell in love with Bruce, I fell in love with my husband. It was just an absolute bolt of lightning falling in love. It's as if a shock went through my body. And we've now been together almost 28 years, and that shock is still there with me. It's as if once I kind of got rid of a lot of the muck of my dating desires, and it clarified to Bruce, my way ahead was very clear. Well, just to be gross and way too self-conscious here, we moved in together within 3 months of first contact, of first meeting. We were living together. It was just so clear what needed to happen. We both fell head over heels for each other, and therefore we were together. Okay, so now let's pull this back to Dante's theology. It's the same thing, that once the desire is purified, the way ahead is clear. Think about this in work, in your passions, in your hobbies, in how you live your life. Once you understand what you need to do, or once you understand that things have been kind of thwarting the actual expression of what you want, then the way ahead gets very clear. You say, oh, that's what I wanted to do. That's what I need to do to make my career more successful, to make my life more successful, to make my life more enjoyable, or in Dante's case, to find God. That's what I need to do. I kind of strip away the stuff that's been stopping me, and then actually my real desire can be fulfilled. Let's move to the last 9 lines of the passage. Then I did as those who walk along with something they don't know about on their heads. So Dante, that pilgrim, still doesn't really know that one of these P's has been erased. And we must admit that Virgil's explanation, while centered on desire, has been a bit cryptic. And maybe this is the point. Maybe the poet, Dante, is focusing us toward desire or delight and less on the actual narrative action of the erasure of the P's. But we'd still have to say that Virgil hasn't been entirely clear about what has happened. And so the pilgrim is a little bit in doubt. So we get this fabulously comic ending to these very difficult cantos. Then I did as those who walk along with something they don't know about on their heads. You know, you're walking along and you don't know that a pigeon has befouled your head. They only know about it because the actions of others make them curious about what's going on. You know, you're walking down the street and everybody's looking at you like, what is the deal with you? How come you get that pigeon stuff on your head? I reached up for answers with my hand by touching and feeling around. It accomplished what sight couldn't at that moment. In the allegory of that poem, this is rather connected to a faith statement. That is, faith is the evidence of things not seen. So I don't have to see this to know it. I can feel it with my hand. And I think we're being referred back to that bit in the Epistle to Hebrews in the New Testament about faith is the evidence for things not seen. We're being shown here that you don't have to see everything to know it. He feels up with his hands. It does what sight can't accomplish. Spreading out the fingers of my right hand. And he really draws this out so you see it. I found that only 6 of the 7 letters were left, the ones that he of the keys had traced on my forehead. Watching me do this, my leader smiled. If we think about these last 9 lines, they are a lighthearted ending to some very difficult bits in the Cantos of Pride. The poem keeps returning to the emotional landscape. And while we've had all kinds of theological and artistic meta discussions on the Terrace of Pride, we've come back to a place essentially of an emotional landscape and Virgil's smile and the pilgrim's lightheartedness. And if you think about it too, Dante the poet is really making a great move here. He's claiming that the climb is easier, it's lighter going than it's been, and the canto itself lightens. It lightens up at its end. It gets a little more comic. It gets a little funnier and also lightens as in it gets easier to understand. By the time we get here to the end and spreading out my fingers and I found out that there were only 6 peas left on my forehead, I felt around up there and I could tell that and then Virgil smiled. This isn't hard to understand. The interpretation lightens up. Dante's done a really good job here of showing us inside the poetry that the climb is easier because the ending of this canto is easier. It's easier to understand just as the climb is easier to do. Great textual and poetic craft on the part of Dante to actually lighten the canto as the climb itself gets easier. So now some questions, some interpretive questions that can be a little difficult. And here's the first one. What's going on here exactly? Can you explain it to me exactly what's going on? I mean, I know what's going on. There's 7 peas on Dante's forehead and they're being expunged. I get it. But is Dante the pilgrim expunged of pride? Has pride been washed away from his life? How so? He isn't died. He's not in purgatory in order to pay penance for his sins. He has not done any penitential act other than walking across the known universe. If he is expunged of pride, how can he return to Italy? How's he going to go back to Earth? Is he going to go back as some kind of unbelievably sinless creature in Dante's theology? Can he be expunged of pride without indulging in the penance of pride? I mean, he's not under a rock. I mean, he did bend down to see the guys under the rocks, right? He did do that much, but is he, in fact, expunged? How can that be without doing the penance itself? Well, he mimed it, but is that really doing it? It's a curious and difficult question, and it leads out to this other curious and difficult question, which has, let me tell you, troubled Dante scholars for 700 years and will continue to trouble them. Is Dante the only one with peas on his forehead? Do all these sinners have peas? We don't see any evidence for that. We don't see these guys under the rocks with 7 peas on their forehead. We don't see people ahead of us with peas on their forehead. Why is Dante singled out? Is it because he's in the flesh, in the body still? Is that why he's got a pea on his forehead? That's where most Dante scholars come down. But if so, why? Why did the angel at the gate of purgatory feel the need to draw these peas in the first place on his forehead? This is kind of what I think, and let me tell you, there are 1,000 answers to this because there's no real answer in comedy. I think part of the system of the peas on Dante's forehead in Purgatorio is to remind us that he's different from Virgil. Virgil does not have peas on his forehead, and he is damned. Virgil is not expunged of any of these sins. He's not forgiven any of them. And I think the peas on Dante's forehead differentiate him from his guide more than from the penitence of purgatory itself. But let me say that is speculation on my part. I see no textual evidence for that in the Canticle of Purgatorio. My hunch is this is the way the poet is making sure we understand that Dante is on a pseudo-penitential journey, not a real one, but a kind of penitential journey, and that Virgil is not on that journey at all, and so has no peas on his forehead. Let me finish this with two big questions, and these are difficult questions. The first one is about love. And I want to go back to that old thesis that started this podcast, that love moves the fence. Here's one of the ways that love moves the fence. This whole bit on the Terrace of Pride has been about art and the passing away of fame of art and how representation works and how realism works and how realism is connected to God's art. And we've been connecting this constantly to Dante, the poet, because it's hard not to, given that these discussions of art have happened all around us. And I want to come back to love moves the fence. One of the ways that love does indeed move the fence is it includes me within that fence, or let me put it in terms of the poem, it includes Dante within this fence. Here's the thing. Fence builders build fences around their realities and somehow believe that as the fence builder, they escape the fence, that whatever system they have set up doesn't, in fact, impinge upon them. I don't want to step on your political toes, but without stepping on them too hard, we can just point to Marx and Engels. Marx and Engels build this system, this political economic system, but in order to make this political economic system work, they have to exploit workers to get works published, to get them printed on paper. So their act of presenting their fenced and, what do we want to say, rather circumscribed vision of the political social landscape, in fact, uses those very forces to disseminate their ideas, which means that there's some way they think they're outside the processes themselves. Or if they don't so think it, they rather subconsciously assume it. And I think one of the things that Dante does that is so brilliant, and we'll see more of this on the next Terrace of Purgatory, is that Dante begins to include himself in his own fence of reality. And while he's moving the fence, as we will see in Purgatorio, to include more and more people inside his notion of reality and more ways of being inside his notion of reality, part of what he's doing as he moves the fence is putting himself in that pasture. This about artists puts our poet in there. And I think that this is an incredibly telling and actually wonderful move. Listen, we all have to fence our world. We all have to set boundaries and try to figure out how the world fits in our boundaries. And if we, in fact, are motivated, as I've told you before, by love, we will eventually move those fences, no matter how much they cost us to build. And in this case, moving the fence is incorporating artists into this theological notion of reality. In so doing, Dante is telling you, I'm not above the pasture of my fence. And that is one of the most complicated things for anyone to do. Listen, Freud couldn't do it. Freud built a fence to explain the psyche, but he himself remained unanalyzable, or so he perhaps thought. I taught last year Freud's case study of Dora in one of the classes I teach, and let's just say we psychoanalyzed the demons out of Freud over the course of that class. But Freud still, he is above the system he creates, like Marx and Engels, above the system they create. One of the hardest things to do is realize you're part of your own system. And I think Dante is doing that. And if we think about this, we kind of have known it all along, because if we go back and vertically read the cantos, go back to Inferno 11 and 12, we go back and vertically read this, we know that in Canto 11, Dante confronts his poetic rival Guido Cavalcanti there. And
those cantos with Farinata had this little hint of artistic pride in them. And we can see Dante starting to figure out that this artistic pride must include him, although at this point he's just got Guido Cavalcanti inside of it with the heretics and with Farinata's proud, or else Guido's father's rather mewling stance. He's got them inside that fence. But now he's starting to put artists like himself inside the fence. And I think that's really important to see. And it's going to play out much more in the cantos ahead of us. Here's a harder question, and it kind of turns on modern deconstructive literary theory. So please forgive me for this. It's an interesting thing to think about. It's pure speculation on anyone's part, and it's going to turn on modern post-structuralist theory. What does this erasure of the P's signify? Having written the P's on Dante's forehead, we would say that the angel does it, but the angels all do only what God wants them to do. Ultimately, if we back this thing up far enough, we would have to say that God is a writer. God creates the P's on Dante's forehead, right? It does it through the angel, but God is still the ultimate author of these P's because the angels are doing exactly what God wants to do because their desires are completely in tandem, in sync, in line with God's desire. So ultimately, God is the writer. God's writing is on Dante. Okay, so that's a little bit curious. God is actually inscribing a text onto Dante. Think about P's as partial texts, but symbolic texts, not full words. We didn't get the word pride and envy and lust. We didn't get those words inscribed on Dante's forehead. We got symbols, peccata, sins of what those words are. But still, God has written on Dante. Then why must God's writing be erased? And this is what's the really curious post-structural question here. If we go all the way back to the grandfather of this kind of thought, Jacques Derrida, and we think this through, Derrida will claim that the very thing that you want to invoke in terms of your philosophical stance is the very thing that will actually cause it to crumble because ultimately you can't hold it. And here, what we would look at, I'm thinking here in my head of Derrida's grammatology, what we'd say here is, as he says about Plato and spirit and the body and the way that Plato can't keep the two of them separated inside of his own philosophy, we would say here that the erasure of the P's is a curious little bit of deconstructive energy in the poem, because God's writing must be erased for Dante to become pure. Does that mean it can't? But I'm going to pose the question. Does that mean that Dante, in order to finish this poem, has to rid himself of God's text, which has been written on his body? No, can't mean that, right? And yet somehow it does. Again, if we just think through this as a series of contradictions, you'll realize that the philosophical stance of the erasure of the P's is much more complicated. Now, of course, just if we go back to simplistic Christian theology. I'm sorry, I don't mean to call Christian theology simplistic, but if we go back to basic Christian theology, we would say then that these P's, the sins, have to be erased in order for the soul to become perfected. Of course, that's that natural bit. But if we push that in terms of its ramifications just a bit, what we're saying here is that not sins are eradicated, because we wouldn't say that Dante is expunged of pride, but we would be saying that the writing of pride is expunged. Does that mean that each terrace that Dante writes about has to finally be expunged out of the poem in order for us to get to Paradiso? If that's the case, then that's a very difficult place for a poet to get to. Is it even deeper and darker than that, that God's writing has to be erased for the soul to finally see God? There's a paradox for you. All of this pushes us out into this speculative, deconstructive world. While I don't think any of this bears on ultimately the meaning of comedy, I think it is a curious move in the poem. It is unsettling. It has never fully logically made sense for me unless I go back to very essential Christian theology, just simply, well, sins have to be gotten rid of. Yes, of course. But why is it in writing? Why are the sins here inscribed on the body with text? And why are those sins not fully written out, but simply inscribed with a letter to indicate their category? And is the category then expunged? If it is, how does that actually work? And when the poet finally loses all the P's on his forehead, all of God's writing, is that when he's able to enter paradise? When God's writing has been erased? How is that possible? Especially since God's writing is, in Christian theology, eternal. All of these paradoxes sit under this. And I have to tell you, the erasure of the P's has always bothered me, because I think there are logic cracks underneath this in a philosophical stance that cannot be described, cannot be reconciled, cannot be made solid, but they sit behind the text. Now, listen, we're going to take the text as it is, which is that the P's have to be erased. But just so you know, ever the post-structuralist sitting up in my mind is going to have problems with this all the way through Purgatorio. One more time, a reading of this passage, Purgatorio, Canto 12, lines 118 through 139. Now, as we were climbing up the consecrated stairs, I seemed to be much lighter than I'd been before, even back when the ground was level. So I said, Master, tell me, what heaviness has been lifted from me, such that going along requires barely any effort? Virgil replied, when the P's that remain on your brow, though already faint, will have been erased as the first has been, a properly directed volition will so rein in your feet that they will feel it's no sweat to ascend. In fact, they'll be delighted in being urged up that way. Then I did as those who walk along with something they don't know about on their heads. They only know about it because the actions of others make them curious about what's going on. I reached up for answers with my hand. By touching and feeling around, it accomplished what sight couldn't at that moment. Spreading out the fingers of my right hand, I found that only 6 of the 7 letters were left, the ones that he of the keys had traced on my forehead. Watching me do this, my leader smiled. Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast, Walking with Dante. Thanks for being on this journey with me. Thanks for indulging me in deconstructive speculation on the passage. Sorry, it's just fun to do. Shows you, A, that I don't take the text as sacred. I just take it as brilliant. But it's fun to kind of go off the rails a bit once in a while and push the ramifications and the results of the thinking as far as they can possibly be pushed until they break. Because once they break, oh, you know, I'm going to come back to this. Love has to move the fence, and my love of Dante's poem has to reconcile itself with the fact that Dante doesn't seem to be aware of the philosophical cracks he's opening up with these erased bits of God's writing. I hope you will subscribe to this podcast. I hope you'll rate it and like it, and I hope you'll continue on the walk with me. I promise not to be too deconstructive in the future. I'm Mark Scarborough, and you keep your shoes tied tight.